to call the meeting to order. No, we're going to start the meeting. We will not call it to order because we do not have a quorum. So when we do have a quorum, we'll interrupt you and call the meeting to official capacity. Today we have Health and Human Services February forecast update and the Healthcare Access Fund update as well. With us today is Sean Welsh, who's the director. Reports and forecasts from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Also Ms. Schneider is with us. She is the Assistant Director with reports and forecasts for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'll turn it over to our testifiers, and you may again begin your testimony, your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sean Welch. I am the Director of Reports and Forecasts for the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Susan Snyder, the Assistant Director of Reports and Forecasts for Human Services.
Okay. Does everybody have the handout? It's 5 pages. Landscape.
Members, do you all have the information in front of you from your packet?
I don't.
The Medical Assistance Program, okay. Growth by segment. Mr. Welsh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to start with, I'm just going to run through and orient you to the document, and then we'll get into the numbers after that. So this document deals with the February forecast, for starters. And medical assistance is Minnesota's Medicaid program. And we forecast medical assistance in 5 basic expenditure categories.
Mr. Lynch, excuse me, we do have a quorum, so I'd like to call the meeting to official call of the meeting. And we also need approval of the minutes. So if someone would like to give me the
move.
Representative Purcells moves to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Mr. Welsh, you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so medical assistance, or MA, is Minnesota's Medicaid program, and we forecast medical assistance in 5 basic expenditure categories. And the first 2 of those categories are on the first page, and in the left-hand box, in box A, is long-term care facilities. Long-term care facilities include nursing facilities, community intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled, or ICFDD, day training and habilitation services for ICFDD residents, and state-operated service programs for the mentally ill. That's the first big expenditure category. The second one is in box B, and that's labeled long-term care waivers. And these include the 5 home and community-based waivers in Minnesota. These waivers provide federal funding for services that would not normally be eligible for Medicaid funding outside of the waiver. And these services are for individuals at risk of needing institutional care. Outside of these waivers, this expenditure category also includes personal care assistance and private nursing services. So those are the first 2 expenditure categories of MA. On page 2 is the other 3. And the other 3 categories are all basic care categories. So these are expenditures for basic health care for the 3 different subgroups. On the left box is elderly and disabled basic care. And elderly and disabled basic care serves about 17% of the Medicaid or medical assistance enrollment. The middle box is families with kids basic care, and that serves about 64% of the enrollment. And the right-hand box is adults without children basic care. That serves about 19% of the enrollment. And that adults without children basic care box represents Minnesota's expansion, or adult expansion program under the Affordable Care Act. So that group originated when Minnesota opted for the early expansion under the ACA effective March of 2011. So those are the medical assistance expenditure categories. The next page, page 3, is the Minnesota Care program. Minnesota Care provides basic health care for low-income families with children and adults without children and legal non-citizens. Historically, there's been some overlap in eligibility between parts of Minnesota Care and medical assistance. Beginning in January of 2014, there's no longer this overlap. Now, beginning January 14, if you are eligible for MA, you are not eligible for Minnesota Care. Beginning January 14, MA covers children and pregnant women up to 275% of poverty. So all the Minnesota Care children and pregnant women shifted over to medical assistance and left Minnesota Care. Also, beginning in January 14, medical assistance covers parents and adults without children up to 138% of poverty. So any Minnesota Care parents or adults without children under 138 of poverty also shifted over to medical assistance. What's left on Minnesota Care then are 19 and 20-year-olds, parents, and adults without children with incomes between 138% of poverty and 200% of poverty. Also, Minnesota Care covers legal non-citizens with income under 200% of poverty. Any individuals with income over 200% of poverty are not eligible for Minnesota Care, and they purchase their health insurance through MnSure. Okay, on the next page, we leave the medical programs and we move to cash assistance. And in the left block on page 4, we have the Minnesota Family Investment Program. This is the Minnesota's Temporary Assistance for Needy Families federal program. It provides time-limited cash assistance and food benefits to low-income families with children. But I believe the expenditures that you see here are just the cash portion of the benefit. In the right block, you have the MFIP Transition Year Child Care Assistance. That's a program that provides subsidies to pay for child care for families on MFIP or families that have recently exited MFIP. And then on the last page, page 5, we have three more non-medical programs. In the left block, we have General Assistance, or GA. This provides cash assistance to low-income singles and childless couples who are experiencing some sort of illness or disability that prevents them from working. The maximum monthly benefit in General Assistance is $203, which translates to about 20% of poverty, so these are very low-income individuals. The middle block is Minnesota Supplemental Aid, or MSA. This program provides a cash supplement for seniors and people with disabilities who receive Supplemental Security Income, or SSI. And finally, the last block on the right there, Group Residential Housing, or GRH. That is a program that provides room and board payments for people with disabilities and seniors so that they can live in the community. And all three of these programs on this last page are state-funded only programs. So that just kind of gives you an orientation to the basic pieces of the February forecast. And now we will we'll start to go through the numbers a little bit. And I'll have Ms. Snyder start with page 1, the long-term care.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Just a quick question regarding the MFIT. Projection growth for 2016. Is that also, I would presume, then the projected increase of those who are eligible? Is that correct? That would justify the increase of the 20%?
Mr. Chair, that increase in 2016 is due to an increase in payments. In July 2015, families will be newly eligible for a housing assistance increase on top of the regular MFIP grant of $110 per month.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Thank you, Mr. Welch. And Ms. Snyder, you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 1, we have the long-term care facilities and waivers breakout. And for all the tables in this document, we're showing actual expenditures for these programs for fiscal year 2005 through 2014, and then our forecast for 2015 through 2019. And these expenditures include all funds, both federal and state funds. The forecasts are used to set the appropriations for these programs in the future. For long-term care facilities, again, these are nursing homes and intermediate care facilities for the developmentally disabled. We're seeing in the data from 2005 through 2014 an average annual decrease in spending of 1.61%, which is shown at the bottom of that table there. And that decrease is driven by fewer people in nursing homes and ICFs. In the data, we've seen an annual decrease in nursing facility recipients of about 3% a year, and in ICF, the decrease has been about 2% a year. And what we're seeing is a shift from people being cared for in institutions to being cared for in the home and community. For nursing facilities, we are expecting this decrease to level off, and we're expecting to see increases starting around 2017 and then on into the future because of demographics. We're starting to see increases in the elderly population that we expect to show up somewhat in nursing homes. Though, in general, we expect more people to be served in the community through waiver programs. The next block, Block B, is the long-term care waiver forecast. And again, you see actuals for 2005 through 2014 and then our projections for 2015 through 2019. And here, the growth in the data has been an annual increase of about 7% a year, 7.19%. And that's partially more recipients using these programs and partially average costs increasing. So again, the big part of these waivers, these waiver expenditures, we have five waivers. The waiver for the developmentally disabled, which is for people who are at risk of placement in an intermediate care facility. We have the elderly waiver for people at risk of placement in nursing facilities. We have the CADI waiver, which is the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals waiver, which is for disabled individuals who are at risk of placement in nursing facilities. And we have the CAC waiver, Community Alternatives Alternative Care, for individuals who are chronically ill and would otherwise be in hospitals. And we have the brain injury waiver for people who would otherwise be in nursing facilities or hospitals.
Pardon me, Ms. Snyder. We have a question from a member, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Snyder. And I'm assuming that these projections are based on current policy, but don't necessarily reflect the impact of, for example, the Olmstead Plan or other things that we've committed to but have not yet implemented. Is that correct?
Ms. Snyder.
Representative, Mr. Chair, the forecast is based on actual expenditures in the past and current law, and would build in any policy changes which are expected to occur under current law.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Snyder, if you could just check back and get back to us on that, because you have committed as a department to the Olmstead Plan as part of the settlement with the court, but we haven't actually enacted that into state policy, and so I suspect it isn't really reflected here. But we are under court supervision to change our service system, and I just think it'd be helpful the more we can understand about that. That would be great. And also, if we could get a breakdown of the waivers individually. And I know we got a waiver waiting list report, but I'd be interested in what these projections would look like if we actually fully served people who are eligible for the waivers.
Ms. Snyder.
Representative, Mr. Chair, we can get you information about the Olmstead Plan and the breakout of the waivers, the waiting list report. In our forecast for the waivers, the two programs that have waiting lists are the Developmentally Disabled Waiver and CADI, the Community Alternatives for Disabled. The CADI waiver will no longer have enrollment caps as of July, and so in the forecast period, that waiting list should be diminished.
Very good. Ms. Snyder, you may continue.
So the growth in the waivers, again, is partially growth in recipients and partially growth in average payments. In the forecast years, the highest growth area as far as recipients are concerned is we are expecting higher growth in CADI, about 7% per year in the forecast period as those enrollment caps are lifted. In DD, we're expecting about 3% recipient growth. In elderly waiver, we're expecting about 2%. Growth in elderly waiver is decreased somewhat in the short term because of implementation of new level of care definitions around who's eligible for the waiver. But we expect more growth in the long run, again, because of demographics. So in total, in the block on the far right, the total long-term care, when we add together facilities and waiver expenditures, we've seen about a 4.1% average annual increase in expenditures between 2005 and 2014. And we're expecting growth to continue at a slightly higher rate in the forecast period. Again, partially average payment, average cost increases, and partially more people using these services.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Members, any questions for Ms. Snyder and or Mr. Welch? Representative Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Walsh, I just have some questions about the healthcare access fund from MMB, the sheet within the packet. Is this a good time to ask questions about that, or is another time a good time?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we have somebody from MMB who's going to testify on that when we walk through this document.
So okay. I'll wait.
Very good. Any other questions, members? Let's see. If not, then we could call MMB down. Oh, you're not done through this.
No.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Welch. You may continue then.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll move to page two. So on page two, we have the basic care segments. On the block on the left is elderly and disabled basic. And you can see that historically, this group has an increase in expenditures, average annual increase of about 5%. This is essentially about a 50-50 split between the impact of enrollment and the impact of average cost. There are initial decreases in 2006-2007 due to Medicare Part D starting to pay for pharmacy for enrollees in this group. This group, in terms of enrollment, is a pretty stable group, but you see in the payments that there's a lot of bouncing around, up and down, up and down. And the reason for that is historical payment delays, plus some legislatively mandated payment delays into the future. And so what happens is, for instance, if you look at fiscal year 13, there was a fee-for-service and a managed care payment delay that moved money from fiscal year 13 into fiscal year 14. And so what that does is it reduces the expenditures in fiscal year 13 relative to fiscal year 12, which is why you see the slight negative. And moving that money into fiscal year 14 artificially inflates the expenditures on a cash basis in fiscal year 14, which makes that increase relative to 13 look quite big. So when you take a stable program like Elderly and Disabled Basic and you implement payment delays in fiscal years 11, 13, and 15, it makes the expenditure series look pretty choppy, when in fact, on a service month basis, it's pretty smooth. The middle block is basic care for families with kids. This block provides basic care for parents, children, and pregnant women. It has an average annual increase of about 9%. Historical growth is attributable to about 60% enrollment and 40% to cost of care. This group is pretty pretty susceptible to changes in the economy. When the economy goes bad, we tend to see this group, enrollment in this group rise. As a for instance, in the 2008-2009 recession, we had enrollment of families with kids in medical assistance increased by 20%. About 73,000 people came into the program during those 2 years. Fiscal years 12 and 13 show relatively small growth due to limited changes in managed care rates for those years. Then you see the impact of a payment delay in fiscal year 13, the negative 9%. And then beginning in fiscal years 14, 15, and 16, you see big increases. And those increases are driven by enrollment growth due to the ACA. This includes the shift of about 70,000 parents and children from Minnesota Care in January of 14. And it also includes the projected additional enrollment due to income expansion, income eligibility expansion, the individual mandate, and some administrative process changes that are tied to the ACA. The long-term growth you can see in fiscal years 18 and 19 is about 5% for this group. The last group, the adults without children basic care, this group, as I said earlier, is our Medicaid adult expansion group under the ACA. And beginning in March of 2011, under the early expansion, we shifted about 50,000 adults without children under 75 of poverty from Minnesota Care to MA. That enrollment remained pretty stable until the end of calendar year 13. For instance, in July of 13, we had about 57,000 enrollees in this group. And we currently have about 200,000 enrollees in this group. So when you look at the projections that we did for the impacts of the ACA over all of our healthcare programs, Minnesota Care and MA combined, we were within 2.2% as of December of 14. And so in a program with about 1 million people, we were off by only a couple thousand overall. But that said, we got the buckets wrong. So what we're experiencing is far fewer people in Minnesota Care than what we expected, far more in MA, and then within MA, fewer people in families with kids than we expected, but many, many more people in the adults without children category than we expected. And so, you know, and you can see it in that growth from July of 13 at 57,000 enrollees to currently having about 200,000. The long-term trend for this group, you can see in fiscal years 18 and 19, is also about 5%.
Mr. Welsh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, regarding that fewer than projected from the November forecast, around, I think I saw data of about 10,000 fewer enrolled. And what do you attribute that to? And then just to top of that, is there any possibility of the data that you're giving us now that potentially will be also the estimates could be off? So the first one first.
Yep, Mr. Chair. So that on the next page we have Minnesota Care. And yes, so relative to the November forecast, the February forecast is projecting about 10,000 average monthly enrollees less than what we had projected in November. And the reason for that is that the November forecast and the forecast before that had projected about a 20,000 enrollment bump in Minnesota Care beginning January of 2015 due to the open enrollment period that we recently had. So when we started, so this is a relatively new program, and the phase-in for the relatively new program anticipated that the first couple of open enrollment processes that we went through, so the one for January of 14 and then the one for eligibility beginning January of 15, would produce sort of discrete bumps in enrollment. And It's true that in Minnesota Care, you can actually enroll continuously, so you don't have to go through the open enrollment period to become eligible for Minnesota Care. But with all the publicity out there in the media and that, we expected that people who didn't know that would come in through the open enrollment process and apply and then find that they're eligible for Minnesota Care. And so the projected bump for January 15, like I said, was 20,000, and it looks like from our January and February data that we're getting about half of that. And so the 10,000 enrollment decrease is not actually a decrease over time. It's just recognizing that we got about half of the expected bump for January 15 service month that we thought we would in November.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. We have three other members of questions, just to follow up that in a very brief question with a brief answer. So was that a cost savings to the state or just a shift?
Mr. Chair, that was a cost savings to the state.
Of how much?
I have that here. Let's see. That was a cost savings of $17 million in fiscal year 15, about $78 million in the 16-17 biennium, and about $84 million in the 18-19 biennium.
Members, did you get that written down? All right. Thank you, Mr. Welch. Mr. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. Mr. Welch, just looking at these numbers, now, if I remember right, the federal government is going to pay for the expansion until, I think it's 2019. Is that correct?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, for the Adults Without Children group, the federal match on that, the federal government pays 100% through calendar year 16. And then in calendar year 17, the federal match drops to 95%. In calendar year 18, it drops to 94%. In calendar year 19, it drops to 93%. And beginning in calendar year 20, it stays fixed at 90%.
Representative Grunhagen?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, and the other thing is, you know, when you look at, I mean, we're talking billions here, and we're seeing double-digit increases in a biennium, which is a little bit disconcerting. But it says 50% of the growth is due to enrollment and 50% to increased cost of care. Are you assuming a certain medical care inflation figure in those numbers?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, which group are you looking at?
I'm looking at elderly and disabled basic care.
Okay.
On the explanation for growth.
Representative Grunhagen, yes, for the elderly and disabled, we assume about, so that long-term trend, if you look at 18 and 19, is about 7.5% or so. And that long-term trend is made up of about a 5% projected increase in average cost and about a 2.5% increase in enrollment each year.
5%.
Representative Grunhagen?
That's the information I wanted. Thank you.
Very good, very good. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask something very similar. I wanted to, first of all, looking at the numbers you've given us, it says they're all funds, so this is federal and state funds in there, correct? And I also was kind of looking for the impact of the federal share and wanting to see that kind of broken out in this, if you could, because... So with kind of following on Representative Grunhagen's question in that adults with no children basic care, that's all the expansion group. So most of that will be even up through the up through what we've got here, the 2019 projection. Those numbers would look much, much smaller if we were looking at just the state only that, I assume, because of what you just explained. And then So I guess you can maybe just kind of confirm that, as I'm understanding that right. But the middle part, the families and kids basic care, where we see the growth in that, and you said due to the ACA, and a lot of that, if I'm not mistaken, is people who would have been eligible anyway but maybe wouldn't have come in because they didn't know it, that there's been a lot more publicity around enrolling. Is that kind of the explanation for the for some of that? Because that's not the expansion group, right? And that's not where the feds are giving us the enhanced payments.
Always nice to know that Representative Liebling and Representative Grunhagen think alike. Mr. Welsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. Yes, let me answer the first question first about the Adults Without Children. That is our expansion group, and that is the group that's getting the enhanced federal match. And just to put it in context, for that group, the state share for that group, once it starts dropping off of the 100%, in fiscal year 17, the state share for that group is about $60 million. In fiscal year 18, the state share for that group is about $130 million. And in fiscal year 19, the state share for that group is about $160 million. And in terms of your question about the families with children basic care, both the families with children and the elderly and disabled are roughly matched at about 50-50. So of the total expenditures here, about half are state funds and half are federal funds. And the families with kids, they're not our expansion group, so they're funded with 50% federal match. And you're right that the additional enrollment in that group comes from two sources. One, the direct shift from Minnesota Care, and two, people who came in because of the ACA due to either the individual mandate, some administrative process changes that were required under the ACA, or income expansion, for instance, expanding the children in MA up to 275 of poverty, expanding the parents and the adults without kids up to 138% of poverty in MA. Those two things, the shift from Minnesota Care and those changes, brought additional people into that group.
Representative Liebling?
Nope.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Welsh and Ms. Snyder. You've done a really nice job of sort of summarizing all the different demographic changes we've made in these different pools through policy choices over the last couple of years, and that leads me to think about how the department is now in the process of securing new bids for these programs under the managed care program. And I wonder to what degree you're translating these demographic shifts to the bidders so that we should actually see the impact of that, because it looks to me like our medical assistance program now will have more, because of the shift from Minnesota Care, it will have more working families. Those tend to be healthier. They'll have, you know, more children, which tend to be less expensive, particularly in higher income households. It tends to be related to poverty. I'm less sure about all the shifts in without more detail in the Minnesota Care program, but we know 19 and 20-year-olds are really some of your less expensive to insure people. And so I'm wondering to what degree you're incorporating the knowledge that you've just given us into the bidding process and asking the bidders to reflect the demographic changes, because they're substantial.
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, for families with kids and for adults without kids in MA and for all of the Minnesota Care populations, we are assuming about a 4% increase in managed care rates, contract year over contract year, going into the future. And essentially when the department goes to negotiate managed care rates, the actuaries use updated actual cost experience to help them arrive and set the rates. So for the calendar year 15 rates, calendar year 13 actual cost experience was used, and when we go to set calendar year 16 rates, we'll update it with actual calendar year 14 cost experience. So you are right. There are a lot of changes that are happening, a lot of case mix adjustments that are happening as people shift from program to program, and you get a bunch of additional people into the programs that you didn't have before. And it's my opinion is that it's going to take a couple years of updated actual experience on these new populations and the new case mix within the populations to sort of start to understand what that's going to do to future managed care rates. And so in the forecast, we've kind of looked at historically how have these trends played out just sort of overall. And you know, projecting managed care rate increases is kind of a tricky business because if you have an area where your managed care rates go up by a lot one year because the trailing cost experience has increased by quite a bit, that doesn't necessarily indicate that it's going to come down the next year or that it's going to go up again the next year. It just depends on what the cost experience looks like as you start to move forward. And so that's one of the areas in the forecast that we don't really try to get it right exactly for every group, every year. We try to kind of find a middle ground that minimizes the overall risk to the budget. And we figure we're going to get it wrong on the low side in some areas, we're going to get it wrong on the high side in some areas, but this is kind of a middle ground that sort of protects the overall state budget. And as we go forward and as we learn more about the populations that we have and that we're getting, and you know, I think we'll start to, you know, we'll adjust that as we go. But I think that's in general how we look at the managed care forecast.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, Mr. Welch, you described what you do as a forecaster. I'm more concerned about what we do as budgeters. And the last time we rebid managed care rates under a new purchasing system and a new negotiating system, we saved almost $1 billion. And that would not show up in any of the assumptions that your trend analysis would show in terms of inflation on health care costs or those sorts of things. It's about being a smarter, more strategic purchaser in the marketplace and having the plans respond to that competition. And so, you know, more appropriately, maybe my question is not to you and how you do your projections, but to how the department is integrating the demographic changes that you've overviewed into its purchasing so that the health plans, when they make their bids, are realizing they're bidding on a healthier population than we've seen in some of these pools before, and that we expect to see that change in demographics reflected in the rates that they're giving us to serve them. And so maybe we need to get another division of DHS responding to that. I didn't realize how much you were just dealing with trend forecasts, but I do think it has some hope for us in the overall budget.
Would you like to respond to that, Mr. Welch, or would you want to continue with your presentation?
Oh, I'll continue if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gruenhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a follow-up question. You know, other states have to be looking at these double-digit increases also and how it affects their state budget. But, you know, just to the testifiers in general, are you aware of any reforms in other states that produce a more cost-effective program under medical assistance and still meeting the needs of the people that are covered by it?
Ms. Snyder or Mr. Welch?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, no, we're not very familiar with what other states are doing in this area.
Very good. All right, you may continue.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So page 3, Minnesota Care. So, again, you can see I'll start with fiscal year 12, and so that's where the big changes started to take place. In fiscal years 8 and 9, you can see some big increases there, and that's the result of the 2008-2009 recession. And it's also partly the result of the end of the General Assistance Medical Care Program in 2010, which resulted in some increase in adults without children in Minnesota care. Then in 2012, you see the negative 25%, the 25% reduction in expenditures. That is due to the adoption of the early expansion. We shifted the 50,000 Minnesota care adults without children under 75% of poverty to MA. And these 50,000 Minnesota care adults were state funded. There were no federal funds attached to those adults without children. So their full value shifted out of Minnesota care and over to MA. Then in 2014, you see another reduction of almost 9%. That is reflecting the January 2014 changes that we went through earlier. The full MA adult expansion to 138% of poverty shifted about 28,000 Minnesota care adults without children to MA. Also at that time, we shifted about 70,000 children, parents, and pregnant women to MA. And these populations that shifted in January of 2014 were 50% state funded, 50% federally funded in Minnesota care, and that's why the impact in terms of total dollars isn't the full impact is there, but it was offset to some extent because that happened halfway through fiscal year 14. And in the last 6 months of fiscal year 14, you had the beginnings of the enrollment increases due to the ACA. So, for example, at the beginning of fiscal year 15, there were about 82,000 enrollees in Minnesota care. And by the end of fiscal year 17, we expect there to be about 123,000 individuals in Minnesota care, an increase of about 50%. Currently, we're sitting at about 95,000 enrollees in Minnesota care. And that increase in enrollment is what leads to the 5% in 15 and the 25 and 20% increases in 16 and 17. We project enrollment due to the ACA to level off somewhere in fiscal year 17. And so you start to see the long-term trend in Minnesota care in fiscal year 18 and 19 at somewhere between 5 and 6%. Overall, between 2005-2014, the average annual increase stated is 2.7%, but that really sort of understates what happened in the program because of all the shifting out that happened. So.
Mr. Welsh?
I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Snyder to handle the cash assistance programs.
On page 4 of the cash assistance programs, the first program is MFIP. This is Minnesota's cash assistance program for low-income families. MFIP actually combines a cash and food benefit for families. Food is the food is paid for through the federal SNAP program. So the expenditures we show here are just the cash expenditures. And for the period from 2005 through 2014 expenditures, you can see the annual trend is very flat, slightly downward. This is a program where the number of recipients or the number of families who use it is very dependent on economic conditions. So the long-term trend is decreased usage, but you see some increases when unemployment is higher. So you can see that expenditures, for instance, rose in the 2008 through 2011 period in response to the recession and then started decreasing again. The benefits for this program have been tied to a standard that's been fixed for, since the program began. The only major change to that is coming up in the future. Again, as we discussed in 2016, there will be a housing assistance grant added on to the MFIP cash benefit. That will be available for about 60% or maybe two-thirds of the families on the program. They will get an additional $110 per month for housing assistance.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Members, any questions? See, I have a question, Ms. Drunhagen. Okay, Representative Drunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question on the medical assistance. You know, through MnSure, people will apply for health insurance, and all of a sudden, they're automatically put on medical assistance, okay? And some of those people don't want to be on medical assistance, but there seems to be no way to get off it. Two individuals. I had two different cases that I'm aware of, and that's a small sample, but it just seemed like once they were put on that, they didn't have a choice through MnSure. Are you familiar with that at all and why that would be?
Mr. Welsh or Mrs. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I am not an expert on policy and federal policy, so I'm probably not the right person to ask. But I do know that that what you're saying is correct, that if you come into the exchange and your income indicates that you are eligible for Medicaid, medical assistance, that's where you are placed. If you are found based on your income and your household composition that you are eligible for MinnesotaCare, which is now our BHP, our basic health program, that's where you are placed. And as to the whys of that, I'm not the right person to answer that question. We can get back to you on that, though.
Okay. All right, Mr. Welsh or Ms. Snyder, I have a question. I ran into Mrs. Jill Anderson. She was my son's first grade teacher, best teacher ever. She works at the food shelf in Delano, and she was explaining that in the county there's been an uptick in folks who have been needing the service, and thankfully to the generous donors of our community, the food is there and the help. But I see in your statistics here there's been a decrease of 0.62%, where I hear from her on the grounds that there's been an increase. Is there any explanation to why that would be a decrease when other areas we see an increase?
Mr. Chair, the MFIP program provides a cash and food benefit to families. There are also requirements for families to receive those benefits. There are work requirements. The cash benefit at least is time limited. We have a 60-month limit. So those are some reasons why take up of the benefit might be less than expected.
All right, is that it?
And Mr. Chair, another potential answer is that these are statewide aggregate projections and statewide aggregate enrollment and expenditures. And, you know, depending on where you're at within the state, and I don't know, we don't forecast it at this level, but it is possible that in certain places around the state, the experience within this program is quite different from other areas.
Very good. Thank you both. Appreciate it. We have a question from Representative Lane.
Not so much a question, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on what you said. The food shelves are not directly related to MFIB. MFIB is actually a program that provides people with a very little amount to get by on, but the people who just go to food shelves are people who are basically living paycheck to paycheck, and there can be months when it doesn't match. Food shelves don't give out food on the basis of your income. They have to give out food to whoever comes and requests because of their need, but they can only come once a month. They serve a different need than this.
Thank you, Representative Lane. And then Ms. Iverson also just to inform me that the this particular, with the MFIT, is for cash assistance, which isn't necessarily the food, although they could use it for some food, exactly. I see. All right, so just on the spreadsheet, I guess that's the cash portion, so it has nothing to do with the
Mr. Chair, on this spreadsheet, we are only showing the cash portion. Almost all of these families also receive a food payment as well through SNAP.
Because, Ms. Snyder, you did mention that earlier in your testimony, the SNAP and the percentage of those are also receiving that.
Yes.
So I got those tied up incorrectly. So, okay, very good, Representative Lang. Thank you for your input and clarifying that. Any other questions, members? Otherwise, we can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 4, the next block is MFIP-TY child care assistance. This is a child care subsidy provided to families who are receiving MFIP or who have recently exited MFIP. And the average annual increase in payments for this program from 2005 through 2014 have increased 3.87% a year. The number of families using MFIP-TY child care in 2014 is pretty close to the number of families who were using it in 2005. So most of that increase has been in average payments. From year to year, we've seen changes in the number of families using it as well, but it's kind of evened out. Right now, in 2015 and last year in 2014, we're seeing fairly significant increases in average payments paid under the MFIP-TY Child Care Assistance Program. And this is related to a number of factors. There have been legislative changes implemented recently that have increased the maximum rates that we pay providers for child care, and also changes that have allowed some providers with certain quality ratings to receive higher payments. But we're also seeing changes in how families are using these subsidies. They are using the subsidies at licensed centers more than licensed family care providers or legal non-licensed providers, and the program pays higher rates for centers. They're also using more accredited care. So that's behind the increases we're seeing now, and in the future we're expecting those increases to level off.
All right, thank you, Ms. Snyder. You may continue.
The last page has more cash assistance programs. The first one here is general assistance. And this is assistance to very low income, it's single individuals mostly, who have some sort of illness or disability that prevents them from working. They are not receiving supplemental security income. They may be applying for it, but they wouldn't be receiving it. The growth in this program has been fairly steady enrollment growth. There's been no change in the standard or the benefit given out, really. It's enrollment growth at about 5% a year, and we're expecting that to continue. The next block is Minnesota Supplemental Aid. This is a supplement to seniors and people with disabilities who receive federal supplemental security income, SSI, or would be eligible for SSI if not for income. And again, this is a population that's seen fairly steady growth since 2005. We're seeing an increase of around 2.5% a year. And the standard has not changed. For most people receiving this benefit, they get $81 through MSA. Then the last table is group residential housing. These are room and board payments for people with disabilities and seniors in various community living arrangements, which are people are placed into these arrangements by the counties. These include things like adult foster care homes or supervised living settings. The growth here is about half recipient growth and half average payment growth. The recipients for this program, some of them are receiving supplemental security income. Some of them are not eligible for that. They're more of the general assistance kind of population. And we're seeing growth there of about 3% a year, roughly. Then the other 3% growth we're seeing is from average payments. There is some increase built into the base rate paid for group residential housing. Also, some people receive supplemental services that they need in order to stay in the community. People who aren't eligible for other waiver services, for instance, might receive an extra payment for supplemental services through GRH.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Snyder. Representative Ruhenhagen has yet another question.
Must be my day, Mr. Chair.
Hey, when you're on, you're on.
Yeah, you're on. Yeah. Hey, thanks for your testimony again. You know, one of the things that keeps going through my mind and why I have questions about concerns and reforms about this area is because of a former state demographer, I think, Tom Gillespie, who's retired now, put out a report, I think it was in 2010, that if we don't get health care costs under control in this state, there will be no additional money for roads and bridges, K-12, or higher ed in the future. And when I look at these percentage double-digit increases, even with the federal government picking up some of the tab, and my guess is that the federal government will back off either even more in the future. That's my guess, just because my school board experience, I've seen how that works. But so my question is, on each one of these categories, and maybe you can get back to me with this, if I gave you a dollar towards you know, elderly, disabled, basic care, I gave you a tax dollar, how much of that dollar actually gets to the recipients versus how much of that dollar is used for administrative cost in these categories? In other words, what percent in these different programs, and again, I don't expect you to answer this today, but if you could provide that with me for me in the future, I would certainly appreciate it. I've read several articles nationally about this, and so I'd just like to see, you're the numbers people, it appears, and is it possible to provide me with that information?
Mr. Welch or Ms. Snyder?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. Yeah, the dollars that you're looking at here, these are all program dollars. These do not include any administrative funding to run the programs. These are all program dollars. And so if you're looking at, for instance, the basic care on page 2, all of that expenditure is either fee-for-service program expenditure or it's managed care capitation payments. Now, granted, there's some administrative money built into the capitation payment, and I'm not sure what that proportion is. But other than that, this doesn't have any administrative costs. We just project the program costs.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, so how do you find out the administrative costs then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that would be a different division within the department, would have the administrative money, or would have the information on the administrative dollars that we spend.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Grun, I mean,
yeah. What division? Grunhagen. Yeah. What division would that be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I guess we'll get back to you on that one.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Liebling has a question for you.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just really wanted to kind of respond. Once again, I think you find that Representative Grunhagen and I kind of share a concern.
Oh, geez.
And it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone because we all should share this concern.
Amen.
You know, even a stop clock is right twice a day, right?
Well,
so I might be right once or twice.
No.
The question about administrative expenses, I think that our testifier maybe took that in part as being about the Department of Human Services expenses. That's in a different bucket. But I think the question about how much of what we pay for our Medicaid program or for our Minnesota Care program, how much of that gets essentially into different buckets of administrative expenses within the PMAP program, within, you know, in our managed care program, because we're doing this capitated rate. And so when we take what's essentially state and federal funds in a bucket that we have, and it's obviously a whole lot of money, and we're sending it out to different entities which then compete with each other for the same group of patients, and to send them through different kinds of networks and provide care to our public patients. I don't know what the numbers are, but Representative Grunhagen, I think there's a whole lot of administrative expense in there. And not only on the side of what we're paying these the HMOs to, you know, provide the care, quote unquote, but also on the side of the actual health care provider, who then has to deal with several different entities as though they had private insurance, right? Because somebody comes in and they might have Medica, they might have Blue Cross, and they are in fact on MA. So I think there's a whole lot of waste in the system. I think we could be doing a whole lot better. And in fact, I have a bill in that would deal with that, would kind of change the system considerably. My idea might not be the only or the best idea, but I really think this is one area where bipartisanly we could do a lot of work. And we all, or many of us, have heard the reports. We heard the Siegel report. I mean, this is not a new topic, and we just, I think, need to figure out how to actually take some action on it, because I think we all recognize that we're spending an enormous number of public dollars, both state and federal, and I think we all want to make sure that those dollars actually buy the best care for our people who need that care at the best possible price. So thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for bringing this up.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Grunhagen, response?
Yeah, I appreciate Representative Liebling's comments there. And, you know, I several years ago, my secretary, one of the secretaries I had in my office, she used to work at the hospital. I wasn't a pair enough, so she went back there. But she told me that what a job she used to do by herself at the hospital back in the 90s, and now I think she said there's 7 or 8 people now doing the same job that she used to do all by herself. So it's not only the bureaucracy cost at the state level, it's what the hospitals are having to put into to administer all this and the amount of paperwork that they're getting. And again, it's been a few, you know, a couple of years since she told me that, but I think she said that a job she used to do by herself, they have close to 7 or 8 employees now doing the job. I mean, somehow I think we're making this situation worse for the doctors and hospitals, and not better through all these well-intended laws and mandates. I don't know.
Okay, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Before we move on to the Health Care and Access Fund update, is there any other questions for Mr. Welsh or Ms. Snyder? If not, I'll just echo what Representative Liebling and Grunhagen said. Remember, Mr. Koppel was before our committee and showed us the pages of when Tom and Johnny's mother passed away, and he wanted to stay home, and he needed help with the work and daycare, and Steve and his father wanted to keep him in the house. They had a very, very good sample of how these programs work and how they affect people. And very important information, I think, as a committee member. But now you two are in front of us with the actual numbers of what all these programs do. And as we see them escalate year after year, well, there's some do go down, so that's good news. We presume that it's improving the quality of life of people. But I hope that the experts, I hope you folks there in front of us who are experts, can not only give us the data, but also provide for us how we can do things better, more efficiently. I'm not sure if that's in your purview, but I'll use that as I'll end it as a question. But I think shared on both sides of the aisles, we all have to come together to find solutions to not only help these people, but also make them sustainable, make the program sustainable. Is that in your purview of helping us create more efficiency and how we can do things better to perhaps save some monies and or at least keep the growths from escalating?
Mr. Chair, the way that I look at our role within the department is, like you said, we're the numbers people, and we take a look at all of our program data over all of the different segments that we've walked through, and in all its sort of gory detail, we have lots and lots of data, and we have some great staff who are able to pull the data and slice and dice it in all sorts of different ways. And we do that because our primary focus is to get the projections right. As a forecaster, you sort of have to be able to sleep at night knowing that you're never actually going to get it right. But we try to get it as close as we possibly can, and we try to minimize the, you know, for two purposes, really. One, to minimize the risk to the state budget. And the second is the better that we can do our jobs, the better the closer that we can get it to being right, provides you with the information that you need, the accurate information that you need to make the decisions that you're tasked with making. And so while we may not be a direct participant in the brainstorming and the decision making, we sort of work in the background and provide the information that allows the policy people in the department and you, the legislature, to ultimately make the decisions going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. Well, indeed, we do expect you to get it more accurate than the weatherman, indeed.
We'll try.
Thank you. With that, we'll call down Anna Mingi, who is with the Health Care Access Fund, and she'll give us the update on that.
Mr. Chair. If the testifiers wouldn't mind maybe just hanging out until the end of the committee, there might be additional questions by committee members for them to come back. So.
Good suggestion, Mr. Chair. Wise as always. Ms. Mingi, you may present your presentation, but for the record, state your name and what position who you're with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Anna Mingi. I'm an executive budget officer with MMB, and today I'm going to give an update for you on the Healthcare Access Fund, specifically related to the February forecast and the changes that we've seen since I was here last and presented the November forecast. So I'll be walking through this presentation, or this handout rather, that has kind of a chart detailing the major changes. But I'm happy to answer any questions as I go along, so feel free to stop me if you have any questions. So you might remember that when I was here in January presenting the November forecast for the Healthcare Access Fund, we were forecasting that in fiscal year 2017, the fund would be in a deficit of $62 million. Now, the February 2015 forecast reflects both increased revenues and lower expenditures in the Healthcare Access Fund. So we now forecast the 2017 fund balance to be $13 million, a positive $13 million. The figure on this handout displays the major changes that contribute to this improved balance. So the blue bar on the left shows where we were as of the November forecast, and the blue bar on the right shows where we are now based on the February 2015 forecast. The green bars in between represent factors that have increased the balance of the fund, and the red bars show changes that have decreased the balance of the fund. So the first major change is an increase in forecast tax revenue. But these numbers come from the Department of Revenue, which forecasts higher revenue from both premium and provider taxes. Relative to November estimates, net tax revenues increased by $13 million in 2015 and $35 million in 2016-17 biennium. So I should add that this chart, because the 2014-15 balance flows into the fiscal year 2016-17, this chart adds up all the changes from both 2015, 2016, and 2017. So the next two changes both relate to lower state spending for Minnesota Care. DHS has lowered their enrollment projections for Minnesota Care, as you just heard, by about 10,000 individuals. This reduces state spending by $17 million in fiscal year 15 and $78 million in fiscal years 2016 to 17. In addition, the February forecast reflects the recent federal approval of a risk adjustment methodology to reflect differences in population health in federal basic health program payments. Now, this is a payment that was at one time recognized in our forecast but was later removed when federal requirements around the methodology changed. The higher anticipated federal funds lower projected state expenditures for Minnesota Care by $33 million in the 2016-17 biennium. So this growth in revenue and decline in expenditures cause sources to exceed uses in the fund, and this triggers statutory transfers to the general fund and the MERC fund. In both of these are new in the new to the forecast in the 16-17 biennium. They are both transfers that occurred in the 14-15 biennium, but because we had been forecasting a deficit, the fund was not able to support the transfers until this improved balance. So this growth in revenues, lower expenditures, and increased transfers then brings us to the new balance of $13 million in the fund. Are there any questions about changes in the 16-17 balance?
Yes, thank you. Representative Dean, Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Ms. Mingy. Just looking at the changes in projected enrollment and also the healthcare access fund balance sheet, and I'm going to reference that if you have that in front of you.
Yes, I have.
Ms. Mingy,
yes. Thanks. One of the things that is confusing to members, and me included in that, is the transfers back and forth out of the healthcare access fund. So I wish you could, when the transfer on the bar graph sheet transfers out to other funds, you said was statutorily indicated but not but couldn't be mechanized because there wasn't an appropriate balance in the fund to transfer the money, and so that when that fund, when the dollars presented themselves, they would be automatically transferred. Could you tell us why that we do that and where that money goes?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that statute, or that transfer rather, is outlined in statute 16A.724. It was established several years ago to pay for a rate increase. The transfer is made to the general fund and is not dedicated to any purpose.
Representative Dean, Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Mingy. And I notice, and I think it's important for members to again remind members that the dedication, once it leaves the healthcare access fund and goes to the general fund, is not dedicated. So those transfers out are important to keep in mind. Also, in earlier testimony this year, it was determined that we, in fact, would have seen a lowering of the Minnesota's 2% provider tax from 2.0% to 1.5% had those transfers not occurred and the balance not depleted. So that these are having an effect on what was the statutory policy of lowering the health care tax in Minnesota. As balances accumulate, we then had another legislation that said that we're not going to let balances accumulate. We're going to move them to the general fund. And the volatility between these two, between the healthcare access fund and the general fund, is not new and not never been uncontroversial. So I think that it's important for members to understand that that this is a change in policy that is affecting where we are moving forward, and it's something to pay close attention to. Ms. Mingy, I want to direct you to the Healthcare Access Fund balance sheet, Healthcare Access Fund figures in thousands, sources on top, and expenses on the bottom. And in that, both top and bottom, there is matching numbers, bracketed numbers to the federal basic health care program non-ads, both top and bottom, that are bracketed, that don't appear to be in the tally of either the expenses or the revenues. Could you explain what those numbers are and why they're there?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, the federal basic health program payments that are reflected on the fund statement are included just for an informational and illustrative purpose to demonstrate the federal side of the basic health program. The funds are actually received into the BHP Trust Fund, which is housed in the state's federal fund. So they are not revenues that are actually received into the Healthcare Access Fund, and as a result, they aren't reflected in the sources or the uses of the fund in any given year.
Representative Dean, Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Mingy. So, in effect, you're just showing a pass-through both from top and bottom from the federal. Is that correct?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, we are a representative. I'm not sure that I would characterize it as a pass-through. Rather, just to demonstrate, to show all of the various funding sources for Minnesota Care, because the funds are not received into or paid out of the Healthcare Access Fund.
Chairman Dean.
Thank you. And Ms. Mingy, one of the statutory changes that we did was we said that we're going to use the Healthcare Access Fund and move those dollars to the general fund to help pay for an expanded MA as a policy change. And one of the rationale for that was that the federal government was going to come in if we were to expand MA. What we were told as legislators was that this was going to be a great deal for hospitals, it was going to be a great deal for providers, it was going to be a great deal for patients, because we've got this 2% provider tax, and here we are working hard as Minnesota. The federal government's going to come in and do that job for us and take it over, pay 90% to 95% of the money. Hey, pat on the back, Minnesota, great job for taking care of these folks. Step aside, let the federal government come in. And oh, by the way, you're not going to need that icky 2% provider tax anymore, because we're going to do that. However, as I look at this spreadsheet, it doesn't really look like that's working out to be such a great deal for us in terms of this. In fact, the dedication for these funds is continuing to be stressed and, in fact, going up. So some of us are scratching our heads saying, how is it that our 2% provider tax is stressing the Healthcare Access Fund at over $800 million per year, but yet we still don't seem to be able to pay for these dedicated funds. Could you tell us what broke in that sequence?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I'm not able to answer the full history of what has happened and what occurred in earlier sessions regarding dedication to the fund, and I'm happy to provide more information to you after I talk with some people who are more familiar with the issue. I can say, and I believe Mr. Welch would be able to talk to this as well, that the BHP payments that we had anticipated from the federal government came in lower than we had expected for a number of reasons. And because the federal payments were lower than we'd anticipated, then the state share had to be larger than we had anticipated. But to the extent we need to further detail on some of the historic changes over time, I need to get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Mingy. And I appreciate that, and we've had previous testimony on that leading up to this, and we're trying to just figure out exactly what the cost of that is and how we're reimbursed by the federal government for that. But again, as we had our initial look at the Healthcare Access Fund and the overall fund balances as we rolled out the session this year in this committee, one of the things that really stuck out was the big gigantic hole in the Healthcare Access Fund that provided to us by this underpayment by the federal government. And we were a little bit surprised that people in the design of this did not see that coming. I know that that we are trying to deal with that moving forward, but just on a per enrollee cost for Minnesota Care, do you have an idea of what the per person per month or per year cost is for an enrollee in Minnesota Care for the taxpayers of Minnesota?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Mr. Welch to respond to that question.
You want to phone a friend? Very good. Mr. Welch?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I believe, I'm just going to, I believe that the average monthly cost for a Minnesota Care enrollee over the entire program is somewhere between $500 and $550 a month.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Welch, remind us again of how we pay for Minnesota Care. What part is enrollee, what part is state, what part is non-state?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, let's see. So Minnesota Care is a premium-based program, and I'm going to be talking about under the BHP now. So I'm talking about fiscal years sort of 17, 18, 19, where we're fully under the BHP. And for those years, the total program spending in Minnesota Care is financed roughly by about 4% premium revenue, about 45% federal BHP funding, and about 51% state funding, healthcare access funding.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Walsh, so it's roughly 90% state, federal, 10% enrollee costs. And do you have an idea of what the per month cost is per person all in? Would that be the $500 figure, or would that be the higher number?
Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I'm not quite sure I follow the question. The $500 to $550 is most all of Minnesota Care is managed care. And so the $500 to $550 figure is the average capitation payment over the whole program. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. And just in kind of looking ahead at this, I think it's important for us to look at this in terms of a policy decision and how we're looking at it moving forward, not just in the next biennium, but beyond that, particularly in a provider tax that is scheduled to sunset in December of 2019. So we're going to be focused not just on the folks in MNsure and the healthcare exchange on the QHP, but also in this BHP, reminded that Minnesota is one of one states in the country that have such a plan in moving ahead. So I appreciate the testimony on that, and I appreciate the focus on the relationship with the Healthcare Access Fund, which I think will be continued to be looking at this from our committee for the rest of the session. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mingy, I am just curious. You said that the BHP payments from the federal government came lower than what was expected. Could you just tell the committee what it was that you were expecting those payments to be and what they turned out to be?
Ms. Mingy.
I think...
Or Mr. Welch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, back when we did the original fiscal note for the BHP, it was projected that... So let me back up a bit. The new way of funding the BHP differs from the way Minnesota Care has historically been funded under the waiver, in that under the waiver, it was funded with a straight 50% federal match. So we spend a dollar on a waiver-eligible person. That dollar was 50% state, 50% federal. once we are under the VHP beginning January of 2015, that match is no longer in effect. We are no longer under a matched scenario. Now, instead, we are funded from the federal government 95% of what that enrollee would have received through MNsure in tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. And so it's a fixed amount of money per person based on their tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. And those tax credits and cost-sharing reductions are in turn based on the market rates, the benchmark rates in Minnesota, and more specifically the benchmark rates in the county in which that individual lives. And when we so now going back to the fiscal note, the original fiscal note for the BHP, we had assumed that benchmark premiums in the state would be somewhere, and I'm not going to get these numbers exactly right, I don't have the documents in front of me, but we're going to be somewhere in the $350 range, something like that, $330 to $350. Instead, when the markets were first introduced after that legislative session for calendar year 14, they were somewhere on a weighted average around $230. So they were about $100 less per member per month than what we had anticipated. So while we were the lowest in the country by far in terms of our market rates, that was a big issue in terms of our state budget or the budget from the Minnesota Care Program from the BHP funding perspective, because the funding is calculated based on these benchmark premiums. So that, to put it in perspective, when I answered Representative Dean's question a little bit ago about the funding shares, the 4%, the 45% federal, and the 51% state, those higher benchmark premiums that we were assuming in the fiscal note drove the federal share from 45%, what it is now, closer to 80-85%, something like that. And so that was the assumption going forward in the fiscal note. Now, just sort of as an anecdote, all of the states around us, you know, Wisconsin, Iowa, the Dakotas, they all had benchmark premiums right around that $330 to $350 range. And if we would have looked like them in terms of the market rates, then the BHP funding in the fiscal note would have been much closer to reality. But instead, we have the low benchmark rates, which I guess are good for consumers, but not so good for BHP funding. And the reality of our situation on the Minnesota Care side is that we have these splits.
Very good. Thanks, Mr. Welsh. Representative Franzen, to follow up?
It was a little deep.
All right. Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, I would sort of paraphrase what you just said by saying we're kind of Minnesota's been a victim of its own success, because you know that having those rates come in so low for the private market meant that we got less for our BHP funding, and that's something I think a lot of us had heard before. But I just want to one comment and then some questions. The program that we have now, the basic health plan, is really a much better program than it was before, than our Minnesota Care program was before, right? I mean, we used to talk a lot in this committee about that $10,000 hospital cap and how bad that was. And, you know, so it's hard to compare apples to apples, I think, when we're looking at the old Minnesota Care program and the new one, because it's got a different benefit set. But having that be understood, I wondered if you could give us some information about how does the per-person cost for the program or the expected per-person cost for the BHP program compare to the cost under the old program? And what is the old state cost compared to the new state cost? So I'm looking for the then and now comparison, both for the individual enrollee average and for the state cost, so that we can get a real sense of, are we better off and are our you know, because I know there's this difference. There's not only these funding differences that you've talked about, but there's also a difference in what we're buying with that money for people.
Right, that was then, this is now. Mr. Welch, right. You want to take that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's actually a tough comparison, in part because the old Minnesota Care, where we were then, included a lot of children, pregnant women. It included some lower-income adults, and those populations have now shifted to MA, and we're left with a much more limited population in terms of income. And so it's hard to sort of compare on a per-person basis. Children are relatively less expensive, and so by, you know, if you shift tens of thousands of children out of Minnesota Care to MA, sort of that's going to leave you with a relatively more costly population compared to, you know, the population with the children. So the per-person comparison is kind of tricky because of the changing case mix. On the total state spending side, that's tricky as well because for a long time, we had a significant population of adults without children in Minnesota Care that were all state-funded. And it's only been in the last few years that once we did the early expansion and moved the under 75% of poverty folks to MA, that the remaining adults without children on Minnesota Care became federally funded under the waiver, sort of in anticipation of the full expansion, you know, beginning in January 14. So the state spending in aggregate in Minnesota Care rises quite a bit in the mid-2000s when that adults without children population that was state-funded really takes off in terms of enrollment with the recession. And then it falls when you shift a bunch of them out and you get federal match on the rest of them. And so there's a lot of financing issues that have happened throughout the years in Minnesota Care as well that makes the comparison in terms of state dollars a tricky one too. That's kind of why when I think about it, I think of it in terms of these shares like Representative Dean brought up. And if you think about going back in time and the then in terms of the shares, we had a higher premium schedule back then, and that higher premium schedule brought in a higher proportion of the funding in terms of premiums. And if you assume, just for sake of argument, that all of the populations were exactly 50% matched as if they were all under a waiver, then the split then would have been about 8% premiums and about 46% federal share and 46% state share. And that compares to right now under the BHP, where we're looking at about 4% premiums, 45% federal, 51% state.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. Representative Liebling.
So, thank you. And so, well, as in most things around here, it's all pretty complicated. But just kind of to, I think, Representative Dean's line of questioning kind of about, you know, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing it, but sort of were we sold a bill of goods and are we really better off as a state with this BHP? And I guess that, as with so many things, it depends on kind of which thing you want to look at. But it seems to me that when you look at it from the point of view of our ability to have our citizens actually have insurance and good insurance that covers a lot of things and doesn't bankrupt them, I think our Minnesota Care program under the BHP is a much better program. And I guess if we look at just like the state, it looks at, from what you've given us, if we look at what share of it are we going to pay now out of the Health Care Access Fund versus before, it looks like we're paying a little bit more. But I guess at the end of the day, the picture is pretty complicated. And like so many things, you can kind of draw from it what you want to draw. But from what I draw from it is that we are much better off in because our citizens are better off.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Welch, I'm just wondering how dynamic is the federal BHP, basic health plan, contribution. You know, we had the lowest premiums in the nation. That resulted in, as you described, lower federal reimbursement. Now they're going up in part because of the lowest cost provider maybe undercutting what was actuarially sustainable. Will we see every year an adjustment, or does the federal government have a slower adjustment process? How do we go forward?
Mr. Welsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, no, you're right. This is going to be adjusted every year, every calendar year when we have new market rates. The BHP funding per person calculation, that funding formula itself is pretty stable. They just published the final formula for 2016 calendar year, and the funding formula itself is pretty stable. But as we said, it depends on the market rates, and to whatever extent the market rates in 16 are different than 15, you know, that will impact the funding calculation for Minnesota Care.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, we're almost concluded with the meeting. Ms. Mingy, is there anything else?
Mr. Chair, no, that concludes my comments. I'm happy to follow up with any questions anyone might have.
Thank you. I think as we close out with the Healthcare Access Fund, we'll recognize that it was started by this body to improve healthcare access and healthcare costs. And I think that Representative Chairman Dean, though, pointed out that as we go forward, the balance is being raided, if you will, into a general fund that doesn't improve the quality of our healthcare and or contain the costs. So I think we will, I think he's accurately stated that we will continue to look at this throughout session, and I believe that we are all concerned on each side of the table and chambers as well. And then I'm going to just throw it back to the great chairman, Chairman Dean.
See everybody back here tomorrow, same time, same channel.
Do you want the gavel, or should I do it for you?
You're doing a great job.
All right. This meeting is adjourned.